28 Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
There's the village, hidden deep in the valley, beneath the mountains high above. And there, 20 years thereafter, Jimmy was to meet his love. Bum, 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 bum.
All the chapel bells were ringing. 'Twas a great day in his life, 'cause the songs that they were singing was for Jimmy and his wife and the little congregation.
I'm tremendously excited about this interview and about the book that we are going to be discussing. A book, a novel called Nashville Chrome. And it is by a very highly regarded writer by the name of Rick Bass, who has won all kinds of different awards. And his collection, The Lives of Rocks, very, very highly regarded, as well as his memoir, Why I Came West. This newest book, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, is based on the real-life experience of what for a time was a remarkable singing group, the Browns. And it is a story of quick success and of heartbreak as well, and disappointment. And it is a beautifully written book. And I say, as someone who is not particularly a fan of country music and largely unacquainted with the story of the Browns, that this book is remarkable in its holding power. And I just could not turn the pages fast enough and found myself just utterly drawn into the story of Maxine, especially, and her siblings Bonnie and Jim Ed, and their lives as individuals and collectively as the singing trio known as the Browns. And I'm very happy to have the next few minutes to speak with the author of this beautiful novel, Nashville Chrome, Rick Bass. Rick Bass, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for that very kind introduction.
I look forward to this a lot. I wanted to say right off the bat, my acquaintance with the Browns, the real life singing trio, is quite limited. And in fact, one of my only tangible encounters with them was when I first started at this radio station now over 20 years ago, almost 25 years ago, actually, and had a Saturday request program. And Christmas time, it was a very special occasion. And I still remember, I mean, I'd been able to answer every single request for all these holiday favorites. And then somebody called up and asked for Softly Falls the Snow by the Browns.
Wow.
And I had no idea who they were talking about. I'd never heard this particular piece, and went scurrying through the racks, and we're mostly a classical station, although we had a few popular things, but I just absolutely stumped, and it just kind of was the first time I couldn't play a request over the radio.
Wow.
And then by George, the next year when we had that Christmas request program all over again, once again, somebody, I have no idea if it was the same person, called up and asked for the Browns' Softly Falls the Snow. And I would go to record stores thereafter, keeping my eyes out, trying to see if I could track down something. Actually, never did have any luck with that search. But in the back of my mind, I've always been haunted by this group that once existed called the Browns. And of course, now as I read your novel, I come to find out that they were a very important group, and and important in their day and should be more important now. And for a select few people, they are very, very fondly remembered. I don't even know where that long-winded story should take us, except I guess it does say something about the obscurity now of the Browns. And that's part of what your book, I should think, is trying to address.
Exactly. That was my first impression when I discovered this story was, you know, a lot of things get forgotten. A lot of, you know, fairly significant pieces of history get buried and covered by other, perhaps less important pieces. That's one of the things that makes history interesting, but and digging for it as interesting. But rarely do you see such import vanish so quickly without a trace. That fascinated me because they were so incredibly important not that long ago in the 1950s. They were essentially the core of what would become you know, the country music and entertainment industry, and they affected everyone profoundly. Greatness was attracted to them.
Hmm. I wonder if you could just say a word about the specifics of their career, of exactly when they rose to prominence and that kind of thing, and exactly the trajectory of their heyday in particular.
Absolutely. They were born in the Depression, incredibly poor, you know, hardscrabble, Arkansas poverty, dirt floors in their cabin, no running water. But they had this incredible resource, this incredible tempered harmony that the three of them shared when they sang together. And it was a very silky, eerie, haunting harmony. And it's what made them so attractive to listeners in the 1950s who had such a status quo in believing that everything in the world was all right, that the Depression was over, the war was over, and there was, you know, everything was just great in the world, and there was no turmoil. Of course, the 1960s would soon arrive with that turbulence and revolution and show that had been a mistaken perception. But in the 1950s, that was the sound of the Browns and the sound the country wanted to hear and was very accessible for that, whereas country music had never before really been accessible. And so that explains their popularity. Elvis Presley was drawn to them. He grew up with them and was a family friend, essentially a member of the family. He was going to marry the youngest Brown, Bonnie, and Johnny Cash was drawn to them and spent a lot of time with them. The Beatles were attracted to them. The Beatles called them their favorite American group and had the Browns come over to England and tour with them for a couple weeks and tried to get harmonizing lessons from the Browns, but they couldn't quite duplicate it. They were just, greatness was attracted to them. And then for whatever reasons, it just went away in the 1960s.
Hmm. One really interesting moment in your book is when the Browns have their triumphant opening night at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville. And you have them meeting a country legend, although it's a name that meant nothing to me. But maybe you could say a word to our listeners about this encounter. First of all, if it in fact actually happened, or if this is a product of your imagination, but whether or not this meeting actually occurred, the exchange between the Browns and this kind of crusty veteran of country music says a lot about what a new kind of sound they represented.
Sure, absolutely. And it was based on a real experience. The Browns' lives were characterized amazingly so by this wild amplitude of ups and downs. They had incredible luck, incredible success. But anytime they had a great break, a great piece of success, you could count on it that there would almost simultaneously or subsequently be a plunging piece of bad luck, and this was one of those many instances. They were still in their early 20s. They were called to play at the Grand Ole Opry, which they had, of course, grown up listening to, you know, back in the woods every weekend. And it was the biggest moment of their lives, and they were very excited. They were about to go out on stage, and one of the legends, old-time legends from the Grand Ole Opry, Little Jimmy Dickens, came up to them, and he did not like the contemporary sound that they were producing, and he could see, I think, you know, how the corner was turning for country music, and what so almost visionary what was going to be, what was going to happen, how it's going to become so glittery and chromy and lucrative, rather than being a, you know, kind of a front porch family kind of venture. And he just kind of laid into them. He said y'all ain't country, and of course that really stung the Browns, because having grown up in such dire circumstances, they their lives were anything, you know, if their lives weren't country, nobody's were. But he was speaking, of course, about their sound, which was this very sophisticated, smooth sound.
And of course, in a sense, that sound is the heart of the story, and it is the reason for their rapid rise, and then it's also the reason why they will eventually be sort of out of step with the musical world around them. You write at one point, the thing that made the Browns so revered, the ability to tamp down any unrest and present a smooth surface, would ultimately be their weakness, but they would be the last to know it. I mean, at some point, the world, in a sense, seems to have lost its appetite for that kind of smoothness in the music they were listening to.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the 1960s were such a profound, you know, cultural benchmark in this country's history, and nothing could have been more at odds with what the Browns were, sound was about. And again, I suspect that's what led to their vanishing, what explains their vanishing in large part. Interestingly, to me, you know, that's what, I'm like you, I kept fixing on that, look at how incandescent their fame was, and then how formative they were for American music, and then look, how could something like that vanish? I just could not stop thinking about that. But that did not necessarily make an interesting novel, and it took me a couple of drafts to figure that out. That's more, you know, a piece of nonfiction or a history book. And I think it was the third draft where I finally figured out, you know, the personal story of how each of the Browns dealt with that vanishing of fame is what makes a novel. So that's where the book ended up exploring most, the personal rather than that cultural oddity, the cultural question of why did they vanish.
It's more a question of how did that feel to them? How did it feel to rise so high and then plummet so quickly?
Yeah, no, exactly.
We're speaking with Rick Bass, and we are talking about his much-acclaimed new novel called Nashville Chrome. And I just want to make sure that nobody misses the point. You touched on it in what we were just talking about before when it comes to the Browns and their very smooth sound, that seems to be where this wonderful title, Nashville Chrome, emanates.
Exactly, yeah. their sound was just so... so slick, nothing would attach to it. And again, it's really interesting. I'm kind of like you. I was not the biggest fan of that sound, which was good. You know, as a novelist, you don't want to be too reverent of your subject. But it's not the sound that I grew up with. It's not the sound of today. Today's music, and it was really fascinating to me to try and extrapolate backwards and see why people were so enamored with that sound, because they were.
I wonder if you could speak a moment, and then we'll dig into some of the wonderful details of the novel, but I wonder if you could talk for a moment about your own interaction with Bonnie and Maxine and Jim Ed, the Browns themselves, as you fashioned this novel. First of all, tell us about the circumstances of your overture to them.
Yeah, sure. You know, it was kind of backwards. It was not so much an overture by me as by them. Maxine is the oldest, and she is was and is driven by fame. Just really has always... burned for it and lived for it. And I was in Nashville on some other business and met a publicist who was familiar with Maxine's and the Browns' story. Actually, it's a kind of a long story. I'll go ahead and wind it up.
We have plenty of time. Go ahead.
Tremendous. So my adolescent daughters were smitten with this country rock star named Keith Urban, and I thought, well, how can I impress my daughters who are starting to grow up and grow away? And one idea I had was maybe I can do an interview with their hero. And so I started pitching this idea to magazines and to the Keith Urban publicists and so forth, and was unable to make any headway. It was a very hard gig to get. And so I went out to Nashville at the advice of a suggestion of a friend who had the idea, well, why don't you start interviewing other country musicians and begin writing for country music magazines and show that you can do that kind of work and then work your way up the food chain. And so that's what I was out there for. And while I was meeting with this publicist, she said, well, I don't know anybody in the Keith Urban camp, but I can I have a great story to tell you, somebody you might want to write about and begin your journey up the journalistic ladder of country music. And so I said, okay, sure, I'm happy to hear it. And so I had lunch with Bonnie and Maxine, the two of the three Browns, and the story that they laid out, it just, you know, my jaw just could not stop dropping. It just got more and more amazing. People just don't live lives like that anymore. Every day during their period of fame was just outrageous. In fact, that was one of the challenges in the novel, was to find some quiet, soft space in between all of the drama so that it didn't just read like a train wreck.
So you become aware of the Browns in this way. Tell us how you ultimately connected with them and how they greeted the possibility of some kind of book and perhaps a novel being written about them.
Exactly. I left off that end of your question. So after our lunch, Maxine, you know, who's just wild about fame, said, you know what, Rick, I want a movie. I've always wanted a movie. All of my peers have had movies. The Beatles have had movies. Johnny Cash has had movies. Elvis Presley's had hundreds of movies. Everybody's had movies. I want a movie. These were, you know, my peers. And she's not modest, but she's so close to it, I don't think she even realizes they weren't just her peers. The Browns really shaped and formed the greats, and I think she does deserve a movie and deserves inclusion in the Country Music Hall of Fame. All of that, all of those trappings that come at the end of a career. But she wanted a movie. So she said, "Rick, can you make me a movie?" And I laughed. I mean, I know nothing about movies. You know, I write novels and short stories, and so I told her that. I said, "Well, here's the best I can do for you: is write a novel that might get some attention to your lives." And she was, she said, "Okay, well, let's do that. Will you do that?" And I said, "I'd be happy to." And I thought it was going to be an easy novel. And of course, the ones you think are easy never are. But that's how we got together. It made me laugh. I mean, so many things in their lives have conspired to tilt them toward obscurity. I mean, even their name, the Browns, is just not a name that's built for remembering. And then when she goes out and tries to find a movie maker, I mean, she throws a dart and lands, you know, on a literary novelist. I mean, that's not, you know, she didn't, she threw it toward Hollywood and it landed in Montana. emblematic or symptomatic of her up and down luck. But
right.
It's a great story, and I think it will rise to people's interest. It's just an amazing story.
It really is. How about her siblings, Bonnie and Jim Ed? Did they greet this project with similar eagerness?
No. Good question. I think Jim Ed was kind of dubious of the whole, you know, he's real practical, and I thought he thought it was a wild goose chase, and he was supportive enough in the writing process. When I'd have questions, particularly about the sawmill, he was very helpful. Their father owned a sawmill when they were growing up, and that had a real influence, I think, on their auditory soundscape of their childhood. And Bonnie, of course, was very valuable and supportive and interesting. She, like many sisters are, was and is the antithesis of Maxine with regard to her relationship with fame. When fame went away, Bonnie did not clutch after it and was actually, I think, relieved to see it go. And Bonnie moved back north to a farm in Arkansas and has been gardening ever since and very happy with her life and content to be out of the limelight. She's amused, you know, tickled by the return of the return from obscurity, but as different with regard to the burning as could be from Maxine.
Hmm. Let's talk about the way in which this novel unfolds, and then I'm really anxious to talk about some very specific moments in their remarkable story. One of the choices you made that is quite striking is that the book does not unfold, the novel does not unfold with sort of a smooth continuity of a timeline, but we are sort of shifting back and forth between events then and events now. I wonder if you could just speak a moment about that choice, and I'm curious about what drew you to it, and also what it's like to actually write the book within that kind of shifting framework, and if there are particular challenges that are involved to make it work as successfully as it very clearly does in your book.
Sure. Well, thanks. There is a... okay, so one of the subplots of the novel or sub-themes is the nature of time, how quickly fame came to them, how quickly it went away, and how long the road stretched for each of them in different ways, some good, some bad, after it went away. And, you know, we visited a little bit about this earlier, and I think what I was thinking when I decided to show the past and then the past and the present, rather than just a straight timeline continuum, you know, a standard orthodox chronology, by moving from the far past to the very current present, I think that highlighted the difference in their living conditions then and now would highlight for the reader that amazing gap, abyss, gulf between fame and no fame. It's a hard gig growing old in America, and Maxine is you know, her life is not real easy right now. It's her royalties were taken for much of their career by an unscrupulous promoter. Not a new story, an old story in country music, and she was a victim to that through much of her career. So she is not living a life of extreme comfort, to say the least. And to show, I feel like jumping from the far past to the present almost makes the reader take the reader's breath away at how someone so famous could end up at the edge of dire straits.
Hmm. I want to read one brief passage in one of these moments in the book where we are in essentially the present day with Maxine, by now an older woman and desperately longing for the fame that she and her siblings had tasted half a century earlier. I want to just read a moment here, if I may.
Sure.
The world, or the world of country music, the only world she cared about, had surrounded her for maybe 10 good years, had swarmed around her and her family. Once it was discovered that she and they were the epicenter and nucleus of it, the yearning and voice that gave rise to what would quickly become the highly commercial Nashville music industry, then that world went on past, leaving her withered and broken like the dry husk of a shed insect skin. That part doesn't much matter to her anymore. She has become accustomed to the physical pain and diminishment. But what plagues her is how she has been forgotten. Being forgotten is 1,000 times worse than the physical reductions, the body's humiliations and betrayals. And there is still just enough of the old curse that was placed on her almost 80 years ago to keep her wishing for more, wanting more, needing more. A little bit later, she is still left with some of the sparks, crumbs of fire that seek to find the last of any fuel she can feed them. But there is no fuel. No one wants her. No one knows who she is or how it was. I'm wondering if you were able to bring her heartache and that heartache, which of course have been experienced by other people, even people who've never been famous, are sometimes caught in that same sort of heartbreaking web of so desperately wanting happiness from a time long since gone. But also the way that plays out when one has been famous and is famous no more. That feels so real on the page. Is it solely from talking to Maxine and having her share what it feels like? Or from what other wells did you draw to write so potently about this kind of unhappiness?
Well, I think we see... It's a complicated question, and it's certainly personal taste comes into it. We all have our differing views on and fears, I think, about the nature of the entertainment industry these days, and what we as a culture do for entertainment, where we place our values and priorities, and what passes for entertainment. Being middle-aged, I sound like every middle-aged person, who's increasingly horrified by what younger people find interesting or entertaining. It's always been that way, and always will be. But it seemed a really rich metaphor with the Browns, whose entire career was constructed on surface gloss and smoothness. I mean, people were saying then about them what people say now about entertainment, oh, there's no substance to it. It's all just sound and style. There's no depth to it. And to see that manifested then in her life afterward, I witnessed a profound loneliness in her, but she did not question her choices in life. I mean, she just wanted more of it. It was not like that she sat around thinking, oh, I made the wrong choices. I wish I had spent more time with my family. I wish I had diversified. I wish I had chased things other than fame. I wish I'd been learned to be content without fame. There is no regret in her life. There's just more hunger, a force of nature in that regard, which I'm not judging it. It was just very profound for me personally to witness it, and very it kind of horrified me that somebody could end up that way, having, served such a fickle master so completely, and then be paying the dues for that servitude after the master left, and likewise, I was so relieved to be in Bonnie's presence, someone who had grappled with that or been tempted by that that situation, and then had conquered it, had walked away and succeeded in stepping away from that. Essentially surface, or in my value system, surface commitment.
We're speaking with Rick Bass, and we're talking about his new novel called Nashville Chrome, a novel, though, which is based very much in the real-life experiences, the joys and the sorrows of a country music trio, two sisters and a brother, known as the Browns. One of the most interesting images early in the novel is that of the forest. That is, at least for a time, where the Browns live. You've already made mention of their hard-drinking father, Floyd, and the sawmill which he owned. Can you say a word more about this image of the forest, where they lived, and how that is important for us in really knowing who the Browns were, or in a sense, what they were made of?
Yeah, exactly. Well, they grew up in this they grew up in this very dense, old, deciduous forest, and their father owned a sawmill, and again, just coming out of the Depression, it was running you know, full time, all the time, just kind of a family operation, sawing their way deeper into the woods. And their father was a pretty rough character, but he was a perfectionist with regard to his the wood that he milled. And unlike a lot of other operators in the region, he would stop midday and sharpen his blades so that they would continue to cut cleanly and make the highest quality of cut possible. And he had discovered that when they were sharpening the saws, there was a tempered harmony that could be reached when the blade was at its sharpest bite. And the Browns, with their incredible pitch, their incredible ear for pitch, would be summoned to come listen to the saw sharpeners as they worked on this steel. The Browns could hear that ringing harmony that the blade made when it was perfectly sharp, and they would consult and advise the saw sharpener when he had reached the perfect blade that would make that cut. And it was such a metaphor for their own talents and their own sharpening that it was just too rich to not use.
Mm-hmm. You also paint this picture of not only the Browns, but just about all of the men, for instance, who worked at this sawmill, of having so little sense of the outside world. And it, what is particularly poignant, I mean, they always knew that they were poor, but at this particular point in time, they have no way of knowing that most of the rest of the country is just as poor as they are. But being as isolated as they are from the rest of the world, they just have no notion. And of course, I suppose this is also an important ingredient in ultimately what made the Browns who they were, and part of what was sort of the mystique that surrounded them.
Absolutely. The formative nature of geographical isolation fascinates me. And time again in cultures, human cultures and biological cultures, biological populations, we always see that. The more extreme the environment, the more extreme the response to that environment. And that was certainly the case here of the forest summoning a certain quality of sound and response to from the Browns to their world. And again, you know, an unanswerable question: why that geographically isolated, impoverished place would why the product from that time and place would have such influence on the rest of the country is unanswerable. But it did. It stands head and shoulders above that time in influencing all the music, American music that came subsequently. Mm. And to think that it came from just a very specific hill and hollow complex, a very small microsite on Earth, is really fascinating. Again, tough stuff for a novel, very interesting for a history book, but tough to dramatize. A light touch is better than a heavy touch with those kinds of questions.
I think you're absolutely right. One of the most poignant stories from the childhood of the Browns, although by this point we're talking about something that occurred with Maxine when she was in high school, is when she was actually named Homecoming Queen her senior year. I mean, she was a beautiful young lady. Although you tell us there were some days when Maxine thought she might be beautiful, but there were also days when she was certain she was not, when everything about her seemed wrong and off. And I thought that was so interesting, and I'm sure she is far from alone in having that sort of uneasy sense of herself. But be that as it may, she is elected Homecoming Queen, and then realizes almost immediately that even though she's queen, she will have nothing suitable to wear. Can you share a little bit about this story from this point?
Sure, yeah. And you know, something I haven't really mentioned yet is that the Brown sound was totally about control and perfection. You know, they were ferocious in controlling the shape and amplitude of the harmony and the sound. And again, with Jim Ed and Bonnie, they were able to step away in their other lives a little bit from that ferocity of control, but not so Maxine. The perfectionism kind of gripped her and carried her away. And you kind of alluded to that with you know, her self-worth, self-esteem, you know, always critical, harsh judgment of everything. And so she was named the homecoming queen, but they were so poor that she couldn't afford a dress for the ceremony. And Bonnie went and told the teachers at the other school, and the teachers went to the football players, and they said, hey, you know, your homecoming queen can't afford a dress. Why don't you all take up a collection for her? And they did. And so Maxine was thrilled. You know, she was touched by the generosity of the gesture and certainly by being able to attend the ceremony. But her father, Floyd, who had a bad relationship with the bottle, found out about it and felt humiliated that he had not been able to provide his daughter a dress. And he said, well, you know, you can't accept that dress from them. And it was just it was a real big knockdown, drag-out fight. And it really, in visiting with Maxine, it seems to me that really was a significant point of departure in her life, away from family, which had been very close-knit and important to her, and out into the kind of the cold void of making her own way. You know, fame became her family, and that was it wasn't a calculated choice, but it might as well have been. It was a profound choice, and one that did not always lead to happiness for her, to say the least.
It was Maxine who entered some kind of contest, actually on behalf of her brother. She made a recording of her brother Jim Ed imitating one of Hank Snow's songs, sent it off to a radio station, and they eventually receive an invitation to come on this program called the Barnyard Frolic.
Yeah.
And you tell us that that evening, when it's first Jim Ed that first appears, but the first time the three of them then came on the program, they received their first standing ovation, more powerful than any drug. But in the wake of that, they encounter this demon by the name of Faber Robinson, who essentially holds them professionally captive for much of their careers. Just say a word about this really harsh reality in the story of the Browns and in other aspiring musicians.
Certainly. You know, these small regional programs that essentially laid the, you know, planted the seeds for what would become this huge, you know, multi-million, maybe multi-billion dollar entertainment industry. And it was common practice for the promoters to kind of scour the woods, just signing anybody who was singing or playing to these lifetime contracts where they would hold, where the promoter would hold all of the royalties and be able to charge whatever overhead he wanted. And the Browns got caught up in that net. It was, again, symbolic of their up-and-down luck. They had also sent before the Barnyard Frolic, they'd sent a demo tape to RCA, and it had gotten lost in the mail. RCA heard their tape and said, hey, yeah, we want to sign you to a contract, but the Browns didn't get that letter back until 2 days after they'd signed with this this really fly-by-night promoter. And these huge shifts in their fortunes that, just by, random chance. Again, they got to fame. They could not be kept from fame regardless. Their talent was too profound. They could have signed with nobody and gotten there, but the path that they took to get there was so cobbled and tortuous.
And for years, they essentially made no money whatsoever, or only the tiniest little pittance. And we sort of just shake with rage as we read about the way in which their gullibility was so heartlessly exploited. At this point in time, they also, as we've touched on briefly, befriend Elvis Presley. And this is a very striking subplot of the novel as well, and of the very different trajectories which the Browns and Elvis Presley ultimately will take.
That very fascinating. They were bigger than Elvis Presley when he started out. He was still wanting to be a gospel singer when he met up with them, and he was just starting to consider the call of popular music and rock and roll. And their mother, the Browns' mother, Bertie, was essentially his second mother. He was just always hanging around at her restaurant and just loved her cooking and would always stop by there on the when he was on the road. And they toured a lot together. And as I mentioned, Elvis and Bonnie were sweethearts and were planning to get married. And then fame kind of grabbed Elvis, and he started rising, continued to rise, and the Browns had stopped rising, you know, in the late 50s, early 60s. It was a fascinating thing to witness. They've got these home movies of when they go on tour and trips with Elvis, and what is striking about those home movies is how incredibly young they were. I mean, we're used to, cultural images of a young Elvis Presley, but not of a, you know, essentially a boy still. It was really amazing stuff.
Another really interesting image which you share repeatedly is this notion of the Browns having no clear idea of where they were, in a sense, in their own story, or in the narrative arc of what their lives would ultimately
right.
be. At one point you write, "Few, if any, map makers can mark the precise moment of highest fame or pleasure in any life, whether an ordinary one or extraordinary, and rarer still are the traveler's own abilities to do so." And another image which you use to help us understand that reality is when you liken the Browns to racehorses. They were like racehorses with blinders thundering down the dirt track. There was a jockey lashing them, and the horses were dimly aware that there were people in the stands, but they thought nothing of where the track was going, whether it was straightening or circling in a loop, or of the consequences of their efforts and accomplishments. They knew only that there was some flyweight jockey on their back urging them on, directing them to do that which they already loved doing. The horse, in its blinders, cannot see, knows nothing of history or of any arc beyond the moment of the next stride. You are using that image, I think, beautifully to describe what it feels like to be caught up in this wild ride towards fame, and of course a ride which at some point, and all too quickly for the Browns, changes dramatically.
They were too close to the story. I mean, it's an old saying, but they, you know, everybody could look at them and see what was happening, but they were the last people to be able to see it.
You also draw an interesting parallel between the Browns and other singers who were sort of along that same path. And I wonder if you could just say a word about what we learn about the Browns when we see them in relationship to someone like a gentleman Jim Reeves.
Yeah, really, really interesting story. He was this very famous at the time and revered country singer, Jim Reeves had signed with the same promoter, and so kind of took the Browns under his wing and toured with them as well. And although Jim Reeves was only about 10 years older than the Browns, he'd been ridden hard and put up wet many, many times, and was just really, you know, at the edge of burnout. And that was a real interesting contrast to hear and see, you know, how they followed his path and learned from him, and yet could not perceive that the person they were learning from, you know, had kind of taken a mistaken path. It was a very very attractive path. They were just chasing applause, but they didn't stop to look at the cost.
Tell us about how the Browns finally found themselves compelled to quit, to disband.
Well, sure. Bonnie had a family by that time, and as did Maxine, and they were both missing their children. They were always on the road. They were not making much money, certainly not split three ways, but and finally they just couldn't go any further. Bonnie was very, you know, very adamant about trying to get back to her family, and Maxine a little less so. They finally did tell their promoter, Chet Atkins, had they'd finally gotten away from Faber. They'd bought their contract back and were recording with Chet Atkins, a legendary Nashville studio musician, and they finally had to give it up. And so Chet said, "Well, there's nobody I enjoy working with more, but I understand it happens. But I'm asking you a favor. I have one more song I want to record with you." And they went and recorded that song with him, and of course it went to number one, and bought them another year of marginal comfort. And then finally, the same situation returned. They just couldn't make a living at it, and said, "We've got to quit for sure this time." Mm-hmm. And they did. And Jim Ed went off and did an independent career. And Maxine had regrets and second guesses. And Bonnie went up to her garden. And that's kind of where they still are today.
Hmm. With these really striking, contrasting stories, for all that divides them in that way, in terms of how they are living with this loss of fame, there seems to be strong affection between the Browns. Is that right?
That is right. Yes, they, their family bonds were tight in the beginning, and they'll be tight all the way through. I mean, there are ups and downs in any family, but they're very tight bonds. Yes.
So, how would you characterize their public profile at the moment? I mean, certainly there have been these isolated little moments. There'll be a retrospective country special on PBS or something, and a glimpse will be caught of the Browns. Are we likely to see more about them now?
I hope so. It's a good question. They're, as you mentioned, they're just these little blips now and again. But I do believe a significant homage by Nashville and the music industry is due them. They were trailblazers for so many things. They established the business model upon which contemporary American music rests and succeeds. You know, the crossover hits. They were the first group to ever have a number one hit in both country and pop, and that's that's the gold standard for today's entertainers who have it quite well. Where the Browns kind of blazed the path and did not have it well.
Hmm. And as you have Maxine saying at one point, one of the things that frustrates her most is that when she looks at those who came after and enjoyed such success and fame, she is frustrated by what seems to be the belief of some that one came before the other or is responsible for the other, when she feels like all that has emerged came from the Browns. It's just that no one seems to realize it.
Exactly. No, it's she spent quite a bit of time being bitter, and she's past the bitterness now, but it still doesn't seem fair, that's for sure.
It's a remarkable novel. Again, it's called Nashville Chrome. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and the author Rick Bass. Rick Bass, I have so enjoyed your novel and this opportunity to speak with you about it today on The Morning Show. I thank you very much.
Well, I thank you very much. It's so kind. I appreciate the interest. Thank you.
The time, 8:58 here on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. Here's a few more moments of the singing of the Browns. Monday on The Morning Show, I'll be speaking with Dinny McMahon, the author of China's Great Wall of Debt, Shadow Banks, Ghost Cities, Massive Loans, and the End of the Chinese Miracle. It looks at some of the serious economic difficulties that the great nation of China is facing. On Tuesday, I'll speak with Dr. Yuri Maltsev, a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, who will be offering his perspective on a number of important questions and issues. On Wednesday, Lucy Lethridge, the author of Servants, A Downstairs History of Britain from the 19th